League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. It's great to have you with us. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Michael Arkish is my guest today, and he is the author of many books. In fact, one sitting on my table over here. But his newest book is The Golf 100, A Spirited Ranking of the Greatest Players of All Time. Michael, thanks for being here with us. First, I think I tend to ask this question a lot, but especially when talking about as divisive, maybe is not the right word, but spirited, I think, is the right word, subject about trying to rank the best golfers of all time. Why get into the snake pit and try to make your own ranking?
Well, because I've always been fascinated by greatness and how we evaluate greatness, how we define greatness. And golf, being an individual sport, I think lends itself to an easier way of doing it, because you don't have to rely on a point guard to get you the ball. You don't have to rely on being the coach putting you in the right position. It's what you do on the course. It's all on you. And the questions have been asked all the time: who's better, Tiger or Jack? Who's better, Hogan or Jones? And I wanted to do my own research and my own metric system to kind of figure that out. And that's one of the reasons I went about it.
How did you kind of start by trying to break down the different eras of golf, right? I mean, obviously equipment has changed, architecture's changed, agronomy's changed, strength changed. Literally everything has changed about golf in the space of the ranking that you could offer here, from the Tom Morrises of the world all the way to the present day. How did you try to take those changes unto eras unto themselves, or maybe flatten them out over the course of time?
I basically decided not to compare eras in a way, because that is really too hard to do. And there's no, because of the change, as you mentioned, the changes in equipment, the changes in the golf course, nutrition, all the support systems that the players have now that Ben Hogan didn't have, that Leo Diegel didn't have. It's impossible to do that. And Bobby Jones even made a great quote about how you only can judge a player by what he or she does in the era they play in. You can't compare them. Yet, I still did it, right? I still decided that I wanted to see how great they were in their own era. But then I also wanted to kind of compile the numbers they had and see how they would compare to others. I still believe that a lot of players back then would be great now, even with all the change. I mean, with the change, can you imagine, let's say, Bobby Jones playing with the clubs of today? I mean, it'd be unbelievable.
To that point, I do think about that sometimes. And I know Tiger has talked about this quite a bit, especially in more of the sunset years of his dominant career, about the equipment being so much better now, almost kind of indicting the younger players to a degree of the equipment so good that it's so much easier for them to play high-level golf. But also that Jack Nicklaus would have been incredible to another degree had he had modern equipment. For you, do you think there's a kind of cutoff point where the modern equipment, the step up from that prior generation or two, maybe wouldn't have seen the benefit of modern equipment because the technical side of it had to be so specific to that era of equipment?
I'm not sure I understand. Could explain that a little.
So, Bobby Jones playing with hickories, right?
Yeah.
He's going from hickories to steel, but would Bobby Jones have had the same benefit going from hickory to graphite, or now carbon fiber, as we're getting toward that in equipment?
Right. I don't know, and I didn't even address that. And I think there's certain inherent qualities in a person that define their greatness beyond whatever elements you want to use to compare eras. I mean, I think that, again, I think all the players, I think old Tom Morris would be great now. I really do. Because it's still that the mental part of it is so huge. And of how do they control their flaws? How do they channel their energy, their emotion? All those things come into play so much that I think that greatness does continue. They're great. Again, the great players of the past would be great today.
Now, the inverse question I also think is interesting. Would great players of today be great back then. And I feel like we tend to spin it forward of, well, obviously the greats from back then could have done it today. I think that's the prevailing thought. But if you put Scottie Scheffler in plus fours in 1909, would he be Scottie Scheffler that we know him now?
That's a much more fascinating question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I don't know, because there it was harder in many ways back then because of the things they had to overcome. I don't know what kind of mental fiber a lot of these players have now. Do they have the right stuff, as they say, that would have put them in a position to be great back then? We can never know that. But we still have to look at their body of work and try to judge them for what they did against their peers in the era they played.
How much of an analytical, a data analytical component did you try to take across these different eras? Now we talk about performance and kind of weird absolutes of strokes gained and strokes gained by certain style of metric, around the green, off the tee, on the approach, and we try to kind of break down a player into their segmentation of what they're good at and what they're not so good at, and we seem to have come up with the data we more or less coalesce around, but we didn't have that data even 25 years ago.
No.
So how do you try to compile that data around those different eras when, more of it was match play, more of it was variable, the schedule wasn't as consistent from week to week, certainly going back beyond into the 50s and before that?
Yeah, I didn't get into that because I really think it's all about winning. And to me, it's all about winning the big ones, winning the majors. When, and I talked to Wayne Gretzky about it, is how do you evaluate greatness? Is who steps up more frequently when the pressure is at its highest? And I know that we look, the players is this week, right? Or you have big events throughout the year, but it still comes down to the four big tournaments when you have the fields that are great, you have the courses that are great, and when history's on the line. And I think that's really where you have to form the basis of the judgment. I counted individual victories in tournaments as 300 points, but I counted victories in majors as 2,000.
Okay. And why did you stratify the value of majors in an era when there were maybe one that you could play, or
Two.
two or three that not, or the eras where you had, two amateur events as a major and two quote
Right.
unquote professional or open events? How did you kind of segment all of that out?
Well, I put a high emphasis on the amateurs because you're right. The British amateur and the US amateur were so huge for so long. I mean, they comprised two of the four majors that Bobby Jones won in 1930 when he won the Grand Slam. And for so many years, we counted those among the victories that Jack Nicklaus had in major championships. And the best players in the world played in those amateurs for many years. And that's one of the things about the book that was really important to me was let's not forget the value of the amateur. I mean, can you name right now the last five U.S. amateur winners?
I would struggle to get you three off
And
the top of my head.
there you go. I mean, back then that was easy,
Yeah.
and I think that we've lost that. And so I wanted to make sure that that was high priority. And yeah, some players were hurt. I mean, Tom Morris only played in the British Open. So how do we judge? You have to realize that. And what about, the players and that's another reason, by the way, I didn't count any Ryder Cups or President's Cup. I didn't factor that into my thinking because look at all the players who never had an opportunity or were born in the wrong part of the world.
Or those matches would have been a club match, or their equivalent at the time would have been a cross country, cross region, cross city rivalry, as opposed to an international match that probably most of us had never even heard of.
Right, exactly.
It's an interesting side quest here about Tiger Woods because you mentioned the USAM, the remarkable run that he went. And I know a US Junior AM is not a USAM. But to win six consecutive USGA championships, go undefeated, obviously, in all of them because they're match play in nature. I feel like we have, as golf media and maybe as the golf historical community, kind of downplayed that to his detriment because the amateur didn't mean quite as much by the time it got to Tiger's era as it did, obviously, 30 years prior. Do you agree with that sentiment? And kind of looking back on his massive honor roll of accomplishment, do you think that maybe we could put more respect on that amateur achievement later in his life and in his career?
Yeah, I think his run in the amateurs is remarkable. and we're not done yet. And is running USGA events is not it's been unbelievable, and we're probably going to see another stage of that starting next year, hopefully, right? At the US Senior Open. No, I agree with you. I think that people, I mean, maybe in Tiger's case, he's had so many amazing moments since then. It's easy to gloss over earlier ones. But yeah, it's remarkable with any time. It's what Steve Scott, Tripp Keeney, think of all the moments where it could have fallen for him, where it wouldn't. I mean, it's unbelievable that he was able to do all that for six. You count the US amateurs and the US junior amateurs and the US amateurs. It's remarkable.
It truly is astounding. And I talked with Kevin Cook about this when he was talking about the Tiger Slam, where even that accomplishment still feels not quite as respected as maybe it should be 25 years onward, just because it seemed at the time like it was inevitable that it was going to happen, as opposed to incredible that it happened in the first place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You think back at that Steve Scott match, though. That's to me, that's one of like the signature moments of Tiger's career. You know, people, you're right, don't make enough mention of that.
And and that's also an interesting point too. How many moments of fate? I mean, I don't like to. I'm not a believer in luck. I'm not a believer in those types of things. But just kind of moments that shouldn't have happened that maybe did that worked out in the favor of these great champions. You know, it's the more the old Gary Player rendition of "The more I practice, the luckier I get." Did you find that to somewhat be the case in kind of compiling this list that, yeah, it turns out the greats won a lot, but they also got a lot of good breaks too.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think of Nick Faldo in the 1992 British Open. He had a really tough final round, and John Cook was in great position to beat him. And Cook missed a 2.5 foot putt on 17 and bogeyed 18, lost by one. And Faldo again benefited from Scott Hoke's missed putt at Augusta. I mean, there are a lot of majors won by guys who were very fortunate. That I mean, Jordan Spieth, Dustin Johnson, three putted at Chambers Bay on the 18th hole, right? So Jordan got that one. So I mean, there's a lot of times where they did get very lucky. Absolutely.
How did you assess golfers from different eras? Not so much in terms of equipment, but in terms of maybe style of play that they had to be successful. And I'm thinking specifically about the PGA Championship when it transitioned from match play to stroke play. Because, yeah, you did take Ryder Cups and President's Cup out of it, and for good reason. But match play was obviously a key component to one of the four major championships once it kind of established itself in what, 1916 or whatever it was.
Right, 1916. That's right. I think I play. I factored it in. I think in the, especially in the praise for Hagen, who won all those PGAs.
There's 10 in your listing, by the way. It's just so to, not to give it all away, but that's a good
Yeah,
point.
yeah. I mean, he was. I mean, you can make the argument that Walter Hagen, more than Tiger, even is the greatest match player of all time. So I think yeah, you have to factor that in into the consideration. But again, the PGA was only one of four majors, but still. Important thing, no doubt.
Is there, do you find, or is your assessment that there was a different ethos, metal required to be a great match player versus a great metal player?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Hagen was great, and I keep coming back to him because he was great at acknowledging that he's going to make a mistake, screw up a hole. And yet he planned for that ahead of time so that it wasn't disruptive when it did happen. So he was able to brush that off and go on and win the next hole. And yeah, I think it takes definitely a certain mentality, a forgiveness, I guess, of a mess up that great match players have to have.
How did you kind of think about internationally born players? I mean, obviously we've talked about English greats, we've talked about old Tom Morris, young Tom Morris. Those maybe are a little bit unto themselves. I'm thinking more along the lines of a Seve, a Langer, maybe to a degree Faldo, guys that kind of came along at the more or less the dawn of what we understand now as the European tour, that maybe didn't get quite the same access to the major championships, even though they obviously were incredible players.
Yeah, and also they didn't. So many players who were great in Europe came over to the U.S. later. I mean, I think Harrington, for instance, who re came over later, and others, and had, by the way, Patrick Harrington, spoiler, is definitely on the list. Okay, some people might find that surprising, but he won three majors, and I also had a rule in there that anybody who wins three majors after 1900 is automatically in. If you had won three majors after 1900, I would have put you in. No, and you're right. They did got a guy like Jacklin. How Tony Jacklin all those years in Europe. What would they have done if they had started and played their entire careers in America? That's another question we'll never know.
Yeah, Bobby Locke comes to mind too. I mean, players that were incredible Open Championship winners, but were sparingly seen, if ever seen, outside of that championship.
Yeah, let me tell you about Bobby Locke, though, by the way. Bobby Locke came over in 1947 and just killed. He won so many turns. It was fantastic. And then there's a whole sorts of reasons why he didn't play much in America after that. But yeah, he's a perfect example of somebody who would have been fascinating. Gary Player, I mean, it just how many wins would he have had if he had a consistent career record in performance in the U.S. alone? He thinks a lot more majors, by the way.
An interesting case too, since I'm thinking more along the lines of player did very well in the senior majors too. Hale Irwin, whose career was defined by U.S. Open success, as a sub 50 player, but then was other until Longer came along, the best 50 plus player anyone had ever thought of or seen. But obviously, we didn't have a senior PGA Tour till 1979. So, how did the later stages, the sunset era of any kind of golfer, come to mind other than maybe like a Phil Mickelson, obviously won a major, in his 50s.
You know, here's another. I didn't incorporate any results from the senior tour in there, okay? Because I really do feel that greatness is what you do in your youth, not when you play in the senior tour. That said, I mean, I felt like I was a juror who was sort of told to avoid certain evidence and yet couldn't help let it affect my thinking. So Langer, I definitely feel deserves a little bit of a bump for just how he played, how he's performed since turning 50. And what I did, by the way, in any areas in which I didn't quite have official points, I had bonus points. So, for instance, Bobby Jones got bonus points for his amazing contributions to the game. Francis Ouimet, how many people would put Francis Ouimet up there? But let's not forget his impact, his influence on the game.
That's an interesting question too, of how much relative influence, and how do you measure that, especially going back to that international question of Gary Player being, the globe-trotting global ambassador of golf, the millions of miles that he's traveled for the sake of the game. How much does that factor into his reference point versus what he actually accomplished in trophies and tournaments?
Oh no, I elevated. I gave him bonus points for his. He was a sort of pioneer of international golf. Incredible influence among international players. That definitely deserves bonus points. And again, it will always wonder what he would have achieved if he had played full time in the U.S. Tour dating from early around 19. I think when he won the Masters in 61, if he had just stayed in the United States and played. He'd probably have 35, 40 wins on the tour, something like that.
Is there anyone, not that there was negative bonus points, but is there anyone whose
There were
standing
negative points, by the way.
is there anyone whose standing got hurt by not either willfully or just because of circumstances, not traveling as much, not putting themselves out there as much in terms of championship appearances?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure about that exactly, but I did certain players who won a lot of events, if they did not win a major, I deducted points from them. Okay. Like Harry Cooper, McDonald Smith, Doug Sanders, who did not make the list. Because I feel that there's a failure there. I mean, you have this quality of talent, you have this talent and potential, and yet when it comes to the biggest events, you don't come through. I'm sorry, you lose points in my system. I know that sounds incredibly harsh, doesn't it, Ryan? Right?
But no, it doesn't. I mean, there are so many golfers, if you ever bore the title the best golfer never to win a major and you had it for longer than 2 years, if I were going to make a ranking system, I would dock you points too, because
Yeah.
that
Yeah.
means you were at the peak of your powers, at least so many people thought you were, and you didn't get the thing that we all thought you could get in that time.
Well, yeah, and that's the part of the book that probably biggest part that surprised me was all the players who had so much potential and yet did not deliver. Even Hall of Fame players like Els and Davis Love III and Crenshaw even, if you go back and look at what was written about them when they first came out, they were destined to become the next Hogan, the next Nicholas, whatever. And they did really well, but they didn't quite do as well as we thought they would do. And that's a fascinating aspect of golf that doesn't apply that much to other sports. And why is that the case? Golf's really hard. You have to go against great players. You play on courses that may not be conducive to your style of play. And then, of course, the demons that we all have. I mean, I thought of Rory last year in the US Open, on the cusp of breaking that drought in major championships, and he misses those putts. You cannot tell me that the pressure of that moment, even for a four-time major winner, didn't come to him right then.
And I think about these guys are obviously nowhere near probably the top 100, but Justin Leonard wins a major in his career, and you figure, okay, well, this guy was going to be destined for three or four of them, gets the one, and then has this really interesting career arc where he gets a Players and a major, but yet somehow it still feels like he didn't fulfill but 10% of his promise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I asked these guys about it, and some of them were sort of, that's interesting. I wanted to find out later in their lives how they look back on that. Do they sit there and go, are they like us? Do they sit there and go, gosh, like Jim Furyk, I should have won the 2012 US Open. I should have won the Wingfoot Open in 06. I mean, and he says it doesn't bother him. And I don't know. And if it were me, if it were you, right? You're 54 years old. Would you ever just wake up one morning and go, God, why did I not win that 06 US Open or whatever it is? Wouldn't you think that would be the case?
Yeah, I mean, and this is not golf related. This is life related. Where I mean, there are just 99% of the time I don't think about my bigger mistakes in life. But in a quiet moment or just at a random moment, even when I'm not intentionally thinking about, it comes up and you go, man, that's not good. I didn't like that. That was bad. And then shove that back inside. Don't think about that anymore. And I think about Doug Sanders, what you say. I go 15 minutes without thinking about giving away the Open Championship. You're like, I would think it'd be more like Doug Sanders than what Jim Furyk's trying to put out there.
Exactly. And I think of Curtis Strange, I mean, who's a part of the coverage team at the Masters. He was so close to winning the 85 Masters after starting with an 80. Okay. And I wonder, does he walk around there and go, I should be going to dinner every year. I should have a green jacket. I mean, and yes, we all do it as well, but our lives aren't played out in public. Our lives are, and there's a big difference there. I think it would haunt me. I got to tell you, I think it really would.
Yeah, I mean, and it wouldn't even matter to me necessarily if anyone outside of my own brain brought it up, whether, I met a fan or just a golf watcher, and it would still haunt me if no one had ever seen it, if it were
Right.
that important to me, if it mattered that much to that many people, that just kind of let it slip away, whether that's one specific event or just my potential. I feel like that, not that my life would have diminished in value. I mean, that's unto itself, but at least my golf career would have diminished in
Yeah,
value.
absolutely. No, I'm not saying that they're figures to be
Oh yeah.
pitied in any way. No, I mean they became rich, they became famous, they incredibly successful, but there's still a standard of winning that you measure yourself against others. And I wonder, how they feel about that at times.
Were there players, I'm guessing there's a yes to this, but you also have very vested history and or very vested life in golf. Were there players that popped on the top 100 that you either didn't know a lot about or were surprised or how were shocked where they wound up?
Yeah, didn't know a lot about Walter Travis, Jerry Travers, even Leo Diegel. I knew their name, Lawson Little Jr. I knew their names, but I didn't really investigate them that much. And to find out who they were, what made them tick, was fascinating to me. Were there any players who didn't? There aren't really any players who didn't make the list that surprised me. I'll tell you that right now, though, Scottie Scheffler's not on the list, and I'm sure people will be shocked by that. He just didn't have the body of work quite yet. I am planning to revise this for a paperback version, so there might be a couple people I put in and a couple I take out.
And what I love is that you have Mickey Wright in here, and
Oh.
that this was cross-gendered, right? This wasn't just a male list, right? This was a everybody's eligible for the top 100 list. Is there anything that you wanted to kind of punch up about Mickey Wright and getting her in the top half dozen golfers of all time that you wanted people to know about her incredible career?
Incredible, the best woman golfer of all time. And when people see that, they go, "What? It's not Annika?" I mean, I'm a huge Annika fan. She was amazing. Mickey Wright was better. Mickey Wright also, keep in mind, pretty much retired at the age of 34. Scaled back her career tremendously. She could have won 100 tournaments. Great ball striker. Mentally tough. Extraordinary player who I think has not, I mean, part of it is she really didn't do the media thing. She didn't go around. I mean, she gave very few interviews later in life. So that wasn't a priority for her, but certainly one of those. I hope people read this book and understand greatness that they don't forget about her.
Are there any people particularly high on the list or in this 100 list that you think are maybe misunderstood or could have been maybe augmented in your rating if they were more open with the press and the public as opposed to being more of a hermit?
Well, they wouldn't have changed in my ranking system, but I think that, people say Billy Casper, obviously, although sort of they consider him the most underrated player of all time, and I hear that all the time, constantly. And I did some digging into that, and I think maybe there's some case for that, but let's keep in mind he only won three, only, gosh, only won three majors. All right, he's not in that next level. But very high up. But there's nobody in there who I felt like is undeserved. I mean, that's why I did the system the way I did, so that to reward them for what they accomplished.
Most people would probably figure if you're gonna write a top 100 list or a top anything list of the best golfers of all time, your one and two are gonna be Jack and Tiger in the end, whether that's one and 1A, 1A, 1B. How decisive did you feel at the end about where you came down on that?
More decisive than you would have thought. You got to look at Jack's, not just the, and I, by the way, I'm giving him 20 majors, okay? I am counting the two US amateurs. See, the amount of major victories, the amount of second place finishes, so many, and third place
Seconds and
finishes,
thirds.
all of that over Tiger. And look, I understand those who say Tiger at his best was more dominant and better than Jack at his best. But again, it's about a body of work over a long period of time. Who performed better more often and is clearly Jack. Now, that being said, there was a point in the book that I gave serious consideration to elevating Jones through bonus points to number one. Because I from 1923 through his retirement in 1930, at the age of 28, 13 in 21 major starts, he won 13 of them. Okay, that's extraordinary. But in the end, I just elevated him over Hogan, and not in the top two.
And I think, I mean, every once in a while I'll see this kind of screenshot from Jack Nicklaus's Wikipedia page of his run in the majors in the 70s. And just for a decade, they're all yellow. I mean, for people who don't
Yes.
read Wikipedia pages about golf like I do. But yellow is, win, play, show. I mean, just incredible finishes over and over. I mean, there are way more of them than there are not. And for as incredible as Tiger was and stretches, he didn't have a decade where it was straight through nothing but brilliance.
Right. And yeah, absolutely. And I think with Jack, people say, well, Tiger has more players in the field that he has to deal with. Okay, great. But look at the list of Hall of Famers that Jack had to face all the time. Miller, Watkins, Player, Casper, Palmer, Irwin, Weisskopf. I could go on and on. So the quality, the top rung quality of golfers Jack faced in the 70s was of a higher quality than what Tiger has ever had to face. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you start compiling that list, I mean, all the guys you rattled off, they're what, eight or nine kind of main character guys that won multiple majors or were significant foils for Jack. And then you look at what Tiger faced. I mean, most of his greatest challengers in the majors were guys who never did it again. DeMarco, Bob May, consistent on a consistent basis. You had Phil, Ernie, Maybe David Duvall for
BJ a little
about
bit,
15
maybe.
months, BJ, for start and stop periods, but those four guys are it. And I often wonder, do the reputations of what would those guys accomplished if Tiger never
Would there have been
existed?
no Tiger?
Right. Where would they went? Would they split the majors? Would they split the 15 more or less evenly? Well, 14 of the 15 more or less evenly, or would it be a whole bunch of Rocco Mediates and Bob Mays and Chris DeMarcos with one major each, and they get it kind of splinters off a little differently.
You know, that's a great question. And I think mentally, it's the mental part there. I mean, how would Phil specifically and Ernie, really the two that come to mind, how would they have prepared mentally? How would they have entered each tournament in what kind of mood, and what if they knew there was no Tiger? Would that have how who knows how that would have affected them? But those two, I think those two definitely would have won at least another couple majors. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like Phil would have probably picked up maybe two more, which,
Right.
I mean, the difference between a handful and seven, six or seven, I mean, the six and eight, that's a big deal at that
That
level,
puts him on
right? I
the
mean,
next plateau. Yeah. That puts him up there with Watson and Player. And yeah.
that's a different conversation once you're starting to get toward nine feels kind
Right.
of, I guess, because of Gary Player, kind of feels like the magic number of like, all right, now we're in the serious conversation here of top 10 or top seven, as opposed to top 20.
But they both squandered opportunities in majors. I think of Phil, obviously, Wingfoot
Yeah.
and Shinnecock to some as well. They both did not take advantage when Tiger was not a factor.
Right.
So,
And that's interesting to me too. And I think about Phil, and I don't remember the exact number, but I want to say the number is seven different times Phil had the opportunity to statistically be number one if he did something in a tournament, basically where Tiger wasn't, and he never did it. He never was able to secure number one in the world. And I realize there's being number one in the official World Golf Ranking only means so much, but that he had that many opportunities, and I know that he wanted it and never got there, kind of says something about what he was at his best as a golfer, that he wasn't able to get there.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's not, I'm not trying to rip him apart here. He was still an incredible player, a great player. But yeah, but think the classic example to me is Norman. I mean, if you don't count the later British Open when he was in his 50s, but if you count from 90, I think it was from 86 through 96, 13 different times, he had a share of the lead. At least a share of the lead in the final round of a major, and won only two of them. Two for two down, two he gets, and 11 he doesn't get.
Yeah, I mean, and that probably has a weighing effect too on any kind of ranking. Is for if you put yourself in that position that many times and fall on your face that many times, do you get credit for getting there? Yeah, to a degree, but you also lose a lot of credit for not finishing it off. It almost feels like it's worse to have gotten there and failed a lot of times than to have gotten there just a couple of times and won.
Yeah. I mean, we have to have strict standards on what greatness is about. That's why we call it great, because it ascends to this other level. And if it doesn't, we have to call people out for that as well.
Yeah, the example for me maybe is, at least in the modern context, is Retief Goosen. That he probably was a shock winner at Southern Pines, but then does it to Phil at Shinnecock with probably one of the best back nine putting performances on a Sunday you will ever see,
Yeah.
and then fast forward to Pinehurst number two, where it looks like he could do it again, and all of a sudden he had built up an aura that he was the U.S. Open player of this era. Didn't work out that Sunday. Michael Campbell got it, but that the expectation had suddenly turned on a dime from who is this guy to, oh, maybe he's the best US Open player we're going to have in this generation.
Right. That's interesting you brought up Goosen, because he was one of those who, when we went through the numbers, I kind of thought maybe his numbers would put him up there.
Yeah.
But you're right. There was a lot of times he wasn't a factor, so it didn't. Yeah.
Yeah, and we kind of seem to just forget all of the times that he wasn't a factor and reward
Right.
him for the three that he was there and the two that he achieved
Right, exactly.
versus, Ernie, Phil, Greg Norman. I mean, go down the line of guys. But interesting question to you is, would you rather be Goosen or Harrington for that matter? Three win it in a 14-month stretch.
Right.
and got it right those number of times versus Ernie, Phil, Greg Norman, who were there so often but have to live, however they do, with the disappointment that they didn't cash in as much as they could have.
I think I'd want to avoid the disappointment.
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah. I kind of feel like Patrick Harrington would be the perfect person to be, where very few people go, well, Tiger wasn't there for two of them. They just go, you won three. And
That's
you
right.
did it in a 14-month stretch. And then you decided you were going to tinker with your swing and really messed it all up. But what a, almost kind of a brilliant golf mind of take on the film. But, to be that kind of player to have figured it out, did it three times under pressure, and then never had to worry about it ever again.
Yeah, and by the way, you mentioned Mickey Wright earlier, and I think it's important that I felt it very important for me to put women in the book because I feel women have been marginalized enough as it is. I thought briefly of having a separate list for women,
Yeah.
but and it was hard to, I compared women to their totals to each other. It's impossible to compare them to the men's totals. But there were some, a great discoveries for me. Glenna Collett-Verre, the longtime U.S. Women's Amateur Champion. I knew very little bit about her. She was remarkable. Joyce Weathered. Ryan, I will always wonder if I didn't put her high enough because she was unbelievable. Great player. So, I mean, to me, it was a joy of finding out about players of the past that, and that was what part of what inspired me to do this book. I'd read obits from time to time, and they'd be on the ESPN. They'd be on the crawl there. They have 300, 400 words, and they'd be there for maybe a day, and then they'd be gone. And like, wait a minute,
Yeah.
I want. We can't just dismiss them that quickly. I want to read more. I want to know more about them.
That's why I really like this book, because it is 100 players, and that still obviously doesn't give you time to write 50 pages about each one of them, but it gives you time to give them the proper summary, as opposed to, as you mentioned, in an obit, so and so won X number of times, including X majors, and that's kind of you get a stat line, and that's it, as opposed to a better accounting of what they actually achieved.
Yeah, and I feel I'm amazed at times at modern athletes who are not aware of their pioneers, who are not aware of the players who paved the way for them. It happens in every sport. And it's so crucial to understanding the history. To me, and golf is a sport with great history.
An incredible history, a deep history, one that probably still hasn't been thoroughly told in a lot of ways. So hopefully this gets at it and chips away at that kind of pile of stories we have to tell a little bit better. Michael, can you tell everyone where to get the book and where to get in touch with you if they want to talk with you or debate a little bit about this?
Well, you can go on Amazon.com. That's one place. Also, the book is being published by Doubleday, so there's a Penguin Random House link that you can check on. I don't have it right in front of me. I could give, I don't know, but get it
We'll
to you
post
later.
links in the descriptions of all the
Okay.
episodes so people can find it. And then
That's
also
great.
if people want to reach out to you and kind of give their two cents on things.
Yeah, probably the best way. Can I get you a publicist number and all that? That's probably the best thing to do.
Yeah,
Okay.
absolutely. We'll put all that stuff together as well, put in the show description, show notes, so
Okay.
everyone can have their own debate if they're
But
so thinking.
I want people, and you know what? I want people to challenge me. I want them to say, how could you not put this guy on the list? How could you put this guy number 23? Bring it on, is how I feel. Let's have the debate.
I love it. Well, Michael Arkish, thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate it. Thanks for the conversation, and thanks for the book to give us such good fodder.
Thanks, Ryan.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.